and pet rescue shelters, because as I look at those pets, I can almost hear them say, "Won't you look at me? Won't you take me home with you? I've been waiting for someone like you to come along. Please, don't leave me here. Please take me home with you." Now for me, it's heart-wrenching as I see those little pets in those cages, and I want to do something about it. And you know, that's nothing like learning about all the children that are waiting to be taken by foster parents. You can find many of their pictures on the internet. Some of them have been waiting for foster parents or adoptive parents for 5 or 10 years. Each year, more than 20,000 children age out of foster care without ever being adopted. Today, there are 108,000 children in foster care that are waiting to be adopted. You know the wait is hard. One of my greatest faults is that I haven't learned the art of patience. I do not like, as I have told you before, sitting in waiting rooms. I don't care if there are magazines there for me to read. I don't care if there's a TV there for me to watch. To me, they're just not a fair replacement for the time that I'm going to lose sitting in the waiting room. A week ago yesterday, Nancy and I exited 157 and took the I-65 exit ramp at Cullman. And less than a quarter mile later, the traffic stopped. There had been a wreck just before the next Cullman exit. And so we waited. Now occasionally we were able to creep along at 4 to 5 miles an hour, and eventually we were able to get on the shoulder and then go off that exit ramp and then go down the next exit ramp and get back on the interstate. And since there was no traffic there, we felt pretty good about it, and yet less than a half mile later, the traffic stopped again. There had been another wreck, and again we waited, and a couple of precious hours were lost. That's the way most of us look at it. We have a hard time being patient. I appreciate the way that Max Lucado described the problem in his book, You'll Get Through This. He said, "Here I sit in the waiting room. The receptionist took my name, recorded my insurance data, and asked me to take a seat. She would call me when it was time to go back. It's the waiting room. Our assignment is to wait. Can't say that I like it. Time moves like an Alaskan glacier. The clock ticks every 5 minutes, not every second. Life is in slow-mo. We don't like to wait. We're the giddy-up generation. We weave through traffic looking for the faster lane. We frown at people who take 11 items into the 10-item express lane. We don't like to wait. Not on the doctor, not on the traffic, not on the pizza, not even on God." Now, tonight's lesson isn't as much for those of you who are out there as it is for me. And I'll try my best as I share this lesson to remember what I'm saying and apply it to myself. I have been wrestling with the problem of patience all my life, and I have a feeling I'll still wrestle with it afterwards. You know, over the last couple of weeks, we've studied some lessons from the life of Joseph, and tonight, we'll examine one of the ways in which Joseph was so very successful in God's eyes, and in contrast, one of the ways that I am obviously very, very opposed to that. Not opposed in wanting it to be that way, it's just hard for me to do it. Joseph knew how to wait. Joseph knew and understood that he was placed in God's waiting room. And if anyone could recognize the furniture in God's waiting room, Joseph could, because he had been there for a long time. Sometimes when we read Joseph's story in the last part of Genesis, we forget how slowly time passed. What we can read in 30 minutes required decades. The opening scene in chapter 37 took hours. The walk to Egypt in chapter 39 took at least 50 days. Time on the auction block was followed by a decade in the house of Potiphar. Time moved slowly in a foreign land, and it was no better in prison. In chapter 40, we read that he said to the butler, "When all goes well with you, remember me and show me kindness. Mention me to Pharaoh and get me out of this prison. I was forcibly carried off from the land of the Hebrews, and even here I have done nothing to deserve being put in a dungeon." And although the butler pledged to do just that, It didn't happen. And verse 23 of the New Living Translation summarizes it this way. Pharaoh's chief cupbearer, however, forgot all about Joseph, never giving him another thought. And so a day passed, and then two, and a week passed, and then two, and a month passed, and then two, and then a full year passed, and then two. And chapter 41, verse 1 tells us there were two full years before the butler remembered his promise. That's 24 months of silence, 104 weeks of waiting, 730 days of wondering why nothing happened, 2,190 meals alone in his cell, 17,524 hours listening and waiting for the word to come. That's plenty of time to become bitter, plenty of time to become hostile, plenty of time to question whether God's even there or not. A lot of people have taken far less time than that, but not Joseph. He waited patiently on the Lord to do what he said he would do. And the door finally came when the dungeon doors flew open and the emissaries from Pharaoh yelled, "We want the Hebrew. Pharaoh needs the Hebrew." I can imagine them hustling them off to have a bath and a change of clothes before they took him into the presence of Pharaoh. And he knew that the wait was finally over. Now, when he met the Pharaoh, who was this guy on the screen, it's known either by the name of Sennacherib III or Sesostris III, two different ways of spelling, but it's the same person. When they met him for the first time, he probably heard the Pharaoh say something like, "They say you can interpret dreams. Can you help me?" And Joseph responded, "No, I can't help you, but my God can." And Joseph emerged from 17 years of waiting and emerged from prison bragging on God. His circumstances had not destroyed his faith, they had strengthened it. You know, this evening there are a lot of people around the world who are in effect sitting in God's waiting room. They face the same type of questions that Joseph faced. How are they going to view God? Will they view God through the lens of their circumstances, or will they view their circumstances through the lens of God's purposes? Jesus said in John 5 and verse 17, "My Father is always at work." God never twiddles his thumbs. He never stops for a rest break. He doesn't take vacation. He did stop and rest on the seventh day of creation week, but he got back to work the next day and he hasn't stopped since. And just because we're idle doesn't mean that he is. Now, if you could read the story of Joseph after chapter 40, you would get the impression that Joseph's life's train had sort of stalled on the tracks, that his history and everything in front of him was sort of in a holding pattern. But while Joseph was waiting, God was working, and he was assembling the characters. He placed the butler in Joseph's care. He provided Joseph with the correct interpretation of dreams. He brought the butler back to the palace, and knowing the tense political climate that we discussed last week, he blocked the butler's memory. Finally, he stirred the king with weird dreams, and he confused all of Pharaoh's consultants. And then at exactly the right moment, he let the plan come together. God is always at work, and all he asks of us is that we wait and trust in him until his plan can completely unfold. Psalm 46:10 gives us a powerful command. God says to us, "Be still and know that I am God." If Joseph had a theme song, I think this verse might very well be it. If he had one saying that was taped to the wall in his waiting room, this would be the one. Be still and know that God is there. And we can do the same kind of thing. In Exodus chapter 14, the Israelites saw the Red Sea in front of them. They heard the Egyptian chariots thundering after them, and they were facing death in front and behind. And then we read, starting in verse 10, when the Israelites saw the king and his army coming after them, they were very frightened and cried to the Lord for help. They said to Moses, "What have you done to us? Why did you bring us out of Egypt to die in the desert?" But Moses answered, "Don't be afraid. stand still, and you will see the Lord save you today. You will never see these Egyptians again after today. You only need to remain calm. The Lord will fight for you. Stand still. Don't get in a hurry. Don't panic. Don't run. Don't be afraid. God's got this. So while Israel could see the sea and they could hear the chariots, they couldn't see God's preparation. They didn't see God working with the geology at the place of the crossing. They couldn't see God as he refashioned Earth's geology during the flood. They didn't see God preparing a place where over 1,000 years later he would bring his people and would clear the way for them to be free. Now we now know that at the place of the crossing there is a massive underwater land bridge. That land bridge is normally covered with water, but it's an area that scientists confirm can be uncovered if circumstances are exactly right. Now the drawings that you see here and some of the sketches will show you basically what the land bridge is like at the place that Israel crossed the sea. And you'll notice it's obviously very, very different from the area around. God prepared that land bridge. And as best as we can tell, he did it 1,000 years before they needed it. Then, God wasn't finished. God prepared the climate of this world so that at that particular point in time, there was a strong wind that uncovered that land bridge, the east wind. Scientist studies prove that you can do that with a sustained 40-mile-per-hour wind from the east. And it's absolutely no coincidence that Scripture informs us in Exodus 14, all that night, the Lord drove back the sea with a strong east wind, making the sea become dry ground, and the water was split. You see, God was at work. Romans chapter 8 and verse 28 in the Contemporary English Version says, God is always at work for the good of everyone who loves him. And the words of the psalmist in Psalm 37 says, be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. Do not fret when people succeed in their ways, when they carry out their wicked schemes. And God shares a similar story in the book of Nehemiah chapter 1. That book opens in the month of Kislev in the 20th year. I, Nehemiah, was in the capital city of Susa. One of my brothers named Hanani came with some other men from Judah. I asked them about Jerusalem and the Jewish people who lived through the captivity, and they answered me, those who are left from the captivity are back in Judah, but they are in much trouble and are full of shame. The wall around Jerusalem is broken down and its gates have been burned. And Nehemiah responded to all of this with a prayer. And you can read about that in chapter 1 and verse 11. And in that prayer, he asked God to touch the Persian king Artaxerxes and to do that in such a way that he might be able to return to Jerusalem and help his brothers begin the restoration of the city. Now, Nehemiah was the cupbearer for the king. You might say he was the official taster of all of the king's beverages. Many of the royal assassinations back in those days occurred by poisoning, and so Nehemiah's job was critical. He was on call 24/7. For him to be able to leave his post and go to Jerusalem was highly unlikely. And even if he could leave, he had no funds to rebuild the city, and so he turned the matter over to God. Nehemiah asked, "Give me success today." But God told him to wait. He did, and not only did Artaxerxes give him everything he asked for, but Artaxerxes funded the entire operation. God was at work. There's another concept about waiting that surfaces in Scripture. God commanded Israel to suspend all work every Saturday or every Sabbath. The crops in the field would have to wait. Cutting of timber for a new house would have to wait. Selling of merchandise in the market would have to wait. And on top of that, God gave Moses an additional command in Exodus 34. 3 times each year, all your males must come before the Lord God, the God of Israel. I will force out nations ahead of you and expand the borders of your land. You will go before the Lord your God 3 times each year, and at that time, No one will try to take your land from you. In addition to the Sabbaths, three times each year they were to leave their homes. A mass exodus from the place that they were trying to defend. And yet God said, don't worry. I've got you back. I've got this. You come and you wait and you worship, and nothing will happen while you're gone. There's another dramatic example of prayer in the book of Daniel other than the one we talked about this morning. This morning we talked about the one in chapter 9, and I want to take a moment to look at one in chapter 10. Daniel had entered into another period of prayer on behalf of his people. For some 3 weeks, he abstained from food. He pleaded with God on behalf of a rebellious nation, and he just kept going. And he agonized, and he begged, and he pleaded with God. And he waited, and there was no response. And then on the 22nd day, a breakthrough happened. An angel came to Daniel and revealed to Daniel why the response took so long. As I read this, I'm not sure I understand everything that's going on, but here's what it says. Daniel, do not be afraid. Some time ago, you decided to get understanding and to humble yourself before your God. Since that time, God has listened to you, and I have come because of your prayers. But the prince of Persia has been fighting against me for 21 days. And then Michael, one of the most important angels, came to help me. Don't understand all that's involved there. From our perspective, and likely from Daniel, nothing was going on. His prayers seemed to be just like rocks bouncing off concrete. But there was much more going on than met Daniel's eyes. There was a fierce battle that was raging in the spiritual realm. And there were two angels that were involved in some kind of competition in the heavens. And while Daniel was waiting, God was working. Daniel never lost his faith. He never gave up. He never walked away from God. And that's an example for us today. God continues to work, but he asks us to wait. We may not know what's going on behind the scenes, and in many instances, we probably won't. We may not understand how things are to work out, but God does. And God says to us, don't worry, I've got this. Words from Isaiah are a fitting way, I think, to close our study tonight. Those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. One of the hardest lessons for me to learn in life is to be patient and to wait. So many of us are that way. It's so difficult in our society not to be that way. And yet God says, wait on me. Trust in me, because I really do have this. Just trust and believe. If you need to respond to the Lord's invitation, as we always do at the end of our service, we offer an opportunity for anyone who has a special need to respond. If you need to become a New Testament Christian, there's a great opportunity for you to do that right now. If you need the prayers of the congregation for something, there's an opportunity for that. Whatever your needs, we encourage you to come as we stand and as we sing.